Lecture 13, The Apocalypse and the American Revolution.
The English Revolution had led to the 18th century Enlightenment. Isaac Newton had led to Voltaire. The idea that our knowledge could never be complete till the end of days, even though it was continually advancing, had been transformed by Voltaire into the idea that there are no final answers at all. That what we do together works continuously towards an end that will never be reached. There would be no, as Voltaire put it, esprit de système. We would not get any final putting together of the universe because, frankly, man's mind and the universe were not coterminous. And we discovered last time that this led to a whole series of perceptions, a whole set of emotional reactions that we can call modern. Newton had served as the hinge to modernity, and that means modernity has this extraordinarily close relation to the Judeo-Christian apocalypse. And we've seen it in another way, too. We've seen Milton's idea of the progress of knowledge through the interaction of men and civil liberties. People talking to one another, people arguing with one another, people disagreeing with one another, people becoming quite rude to one another, and yet it's a good thing. And this idea of never standing and accepting the light we have, but using the light we have to discover things still further, underwrites the notion of progress that we have seen with the Marquis de Condorcet. The Baconian idea of how people have to interact with science becomes the basis of the French Encyclopedia of Diderot. For Bacon, it was the reassembly of the human mind. For Bacon, it was putting together the shattered knowledge, the shattered personality that the fall of man had entailed. But it was nothing of the sort for Denis Diderot. For Denis Diderot, it was the dynamic of progress, not leading to the millennium, not leading to a final redemption, but leading to indefinite progress. The step is a monumental one, and yet it's not a big step at all. Now I want us to look at another great successor to the English Revolution, and that is the American Revolution. The American Revolution is the flowering of the thinking of James Harrington, which we've seen before. Civil religion, that is to say, Christianity in society, became realized as political democracy. As you engaged in politics, you acted not only as a saint, but also as a citizen. Now, this kind of thinking, this notion that somehow the citizen was also the saint, this notion that the community, the godly community, was somehow also the republic. We find this everywhere, and yet we find it nowhere in the same way, to the same extent, with the same persuasiveness as we do in British North America and then in the great American Republic. Nowhere else in the world is the notion of the historical redemption of mankind more clearly, more closely, more emphatically, more irretrievably associated with the political community than in the United States. England had seen itself as the elect nation, as we've seen. Spain had proclaimed itself to be the heir to the children of Israel and the children of grace. Luther wanted to see Germany as a latter-day Judah. The Swedes, of all people, said, you know our language in its earlier form, Gothic? That is the language spoken in the Garden of Eden. That is the language that existed amongst people of the world before the Tower of Babel shattered us into all these different languages. And if we get to the Ur language, the original language, what people had originally spoken, with it will come the original wisdom before the fall of man. The Swedes have it, And where do we find it in Sweden? Not just by speaking Swedish, by saying pax and mörkret to each other. No, we find it in the runestones. We will decode the runestones, and we will decode the original wisdom that man had before the fall, before the flood, before all the calamities that had, in fact, taken place on him. And yet, for all of that, and yet for all of these claims so variously based and founded on what is unarguably extraordinary learning, America and America alone embrace these ideas with a kind of cogency, a kind of persuasiveness that would never be found anywhere else. America became peculiarly the Redeemer Nation. That transformation is a complex sociochemical reaction, if I could call it that, and I want to explore that with you in the next few minutes. The transition goes from really the Great Awakening of the 1740s to the Great Republic of the 1770s. Let's see how it happened. The colonies in North America of English-speaking people had themselves notions of election. The British colonies were indeed founded with apocalyptic expectations. After all, this in a sense is a Baconian view. Remember how Bacon said, circling the globe, conquering the globe, is but the other side of putting together the human mind and thus restoring Edenic man, restoring mankind to what he was originally before the great tragedy of the fall in Eden. What happened in New England? I bet many of you have heard of this in your history books in junior high. On the decks of the Arbella, John Winthrop said, "We shall be as a city on a hill, the eyes of the world upon us. We shall be a model to nations." And yet, they also didn't separate from the Church of England. The elect nation in England was going to be saved, revived, restored by the model across the ocean. It wasn't a leaving of England. It was a remnant from England that would save England, and from England, of course, the world. This did not involve a repudiation. It was a special mission for a special community for the larger realm. England had been founded on eschatological purposes, and so too had New England. And this kind of sense would go on right up to 1776. But we don't have to look at Puritans to see this. We don't have to look at Puritans to have this kind of sensation. If we look at a much more conservative undertaking, I mean Sir William Alexander's attempt to found Nova Scotia, New Scotland, he has very much the same idea in mind. And these aren't dissenters unhappy with Archbishop Laud. This man is at the court of St. James. He's with King James and then with King Charles. He is, without any doubt, the most powerful Scot in Great Britain. He is, in effect, the Secretary of State for Scotland. And when he wants to found Nova Scotia, he writes pamphlets on behalf of this. He argues this with the king. He looks for money all over the place. He'll even create a whole new order of baronets. That is to say, it's sort of not quite a baron, but a baron monkey. And you'll get a special little ribbon. How about that? And you'll also have to pay a special little price. How about that? And then you can be a baron in the New Scotland. And what is the New Scotland supposed to be? It is supposed to be a model to the world. It has eschatological purposes. So whether we look to the Puritan left or the court right, we find very similar ideas operating. And just to keep the spectrum even, we could look to the middle. Let's look to the Cromwellian protectorate. Oliver Cromwell has what he calls the Great Western Design. What he wants to do is to overthrow the Spanish Empire in the New World. He wants to establish a British Empire in its place. But it won't be like the Spanish one. Not only will it have the true faith, it will bring justice to the Indians. the stories of the horrors that had happened to the Indians had become a part of European literature from Montaigne and even earlier, from Las Casas and still others. And the British were well aware of this. No, there would be a new European empire in the New World, and it would be an empire for justice. It would be an empire founded on the expectations of the latter days. We would eliminate Spanish tyranny for British liberty. So he truly believed. In the practice, it turned out to be a little bit different. But whether we look to the left with Winthrop, or we look to the right with Sir William Alexander, or we look to the center with the Protectorate, the exploration, the colonization of the New World is an eschatological trip. All of these people are looking to the end of days. There will be, coming out of England, coming out of Scotland, coming out of the British monarchies, there will be the Fifth Empire. What Daniel had proposed in his seventh chapter. These communities are all seen as fulfilling sacred prophecy. Now, the notion of exceptionalism, of a special project, a special mission, a special destiny that's linked with British North America, wanes somewhat. It never goes away, just as it somehow never goes away in American politics either. It never goes away, but it waned a bit after the 1690s as these colonies became more integrated into a larger British empire. One measure of the waning of the idea of the colonies as politically being the societies to exist at the end of days is the Great Awakening of Jonathan Edwards. You remember Jonathan Edwards? This is the man who talked about sinners in the hands of an angry God, and at the same time talked about Isaac Newton's physics, and understood it, by the way, and thought that underwrote his idea of God. He talked about John Locke, hardly a Christian at all, but Locke's notion that what we see is what we get, to use the phrase, I suppose, from Times Square, our senses are all we have. The rest is contingent on something else. There's no final reason and structure that we can perceive. That seemed to support Edwards' Calvinist world. Jonathan Edwards wanted to create not the perfect society, but he wanted to convert people to Christianity. It would be a worldwide evangelical crusade. Its measure would not be the creation of institutions. It would not be the work of princes. It would be instead conversions to the truth. It would be drawing in the fullness of the Gentiles, the calling of the Jews before the end of days. We remember from last time, it would begin, he thought, in a moment of extreme optimism in Northampton, Massachusetts. And why not? Edwards' revival didn't really work, of course. Yes, there were other attempts at revival. George Whitefield came over from England and preached in the tradition of Edwards. Whitefield, with no electronic amplification, Ben Franklin said, could talk to as many as 2,000 people and be heard. Now, that was a voice. Ben Franklin said this about Whitefield, and he could have said the same thing about Jonathan Edwards. He said, that man could induce a conversion experience, you know, feeling the Spirit, rolling on the ground, speaking in tongues. He could do that with a voice like his by simply saying, Mesopotamia. The voice did the trick. The importance, though, of what Edwards was up to, and these other revivals as well, was not so much that they stimulated apocalyptic thinking. That had always been there. They got people going. They did something else that they hadn't intended to do. They fragmented people's religion. Now there were huge Presbyterian minorities off in Massachusetts. Now there were Baptists all over the place. There was no single religion identified with a particular colony. By scrambling the religions, it became possible to think not of New England or Massachusetts, not to think of Pennsylvania, not to think of whatever other colony might exist as the city on the hill, but all of them are now the city on the hill. There is a common notion of a community that extends along the entire seaboard. What Jonathan Edwards achieves, the Great Awakening, is to fragment and scatter, and to fragment and scatter, making the possibility of an American nation. The apocalypse now becomes everybody's currency. And it doesn't matter too much if you make the mistake of being a Presbyterian. It doesn't matter all that much if you screw up and become a Quaker. It doesn't matter even if you become a Catholic. Oh, it doesn't really matter. So long as you have the Spirit, brothers and sisters, we are part of a common community that defines itself as the Redeemer Nation. This fragmentation changes the elect community into the Messianic Nation. The American colonies taken together would be the tribes of Israel. America would indeed see itself as redeeming the promise of Israel. It's a standard theological notion to say that the promises in the Old Testament, the fulfillment is in the New Testament. The promise of Israel is fulfilled, not simply in the New Testament, but in the realization of the New Testament. And where is the New Testament realized? Where else, of course? In America. The connection between the two was something Americans never tired of pointing out. The minister, Cyprian Strong, in 1777, right after the Declaration of Independence, makes this statement, and this could be replicated thousands of times. He says, "I trust there is no one whose mind is not at once struck with the description of Israel as being a most perfect resemblance of these American colonies, almost as much so as if spoken with primary reference to them. When God thought of Israel, he thought of America." And it wasn't just Massachusetts. It wasn't just New England. It was the whole kit and caboodle. It was all of the colonies. This is the vocabulary of revolution, or one of its vocabularies. There will be a secular vocabulary of Thomas Jefferson, the deist. But the people at Harvard, the people at Yale, and so many of the guys in the front lines with the guns thought in these terms. They were Republicans. They were Democrats. They were radical. And they were redeeming the world. They were also deeply Christian. When Benjamin Franklin went off to negotiate in London, the way Americans wanted to remember it, it's a style of literature totally vanished today, and yet it's remarkable. And let me just sort of paraphrase a few lines of it. You'll get a sense of it. "And there the Benjamite went before the court of Pharaoh." That's King George III. The Benjamite, of course, is Benjamin Franklin. "And the Benjamite said," and there's a line from Scripture, "and then Pharaoh smote his breast and said, no." You see the negotiations? The negotiations are the negotiations with Pharaoh. "Let my people go." Or alternatively, adopt Judaism, which would become pretty much the same thing. The war for independence, the American Revolution, was thus a revolt not just against Antichrist, understood as the papacy, but it was a revolt against Antichrist as political tyranny. The two had become identified. And this would be American political rhetoric for a very long time indeed. The biblical vocabulary would inspire literally thousands, no more than thousands. There are 2 million, 2 to 3 million people in the colonies, and you've got at least 1 million and 1.5 million who see the world through these terms. But if the struggle against Britain is the struggle against Antichrist, if Whitehall is the papacy, only worse than the papacy, America is a special nation. It resembles Israel, pre-monarchical Israel. It resembles Republican Israel. It follows the line of James Harrington. It is not just Israel. It is also the classical republic. The Hebrew Commonwealth and the classical republic are identified. Harrington had said God had revealed by revelation to the Hebrews the nature of man's salvation through politics. Greeks and the Romans had discovered it from nature themselves. And thus the virtuous citizen was the same thing as the righteous saint. Moreover, Harrington had linked this view with a vision of historical development and a remarkably sophisticated historical sociology, as we've seen. And now we find American variants on exactly the same thing. John Adams writes what he calls a dissertation on the canon and feudal law. The rise of Antichrist, not just the papacy, the rise of Antichrist is the rise of feudal law, the rise of canon law. It's not just the Pope, but it is dependence generally, and that dependence is the result of tyranny as well. The British monarchy, even more than the papacy, is where Antichrist is located. And the struggle for human redemption, the struggle for what people really are about, the purpose of the whole human experience in time, is going to be realized with the American Revolution. Christian virtue and republican civic virtue come to be identified. Despotic government, not just the hierarchy of religious hierarchy in the papacy and in Catholicism, the hierarchy there in London. The bureaucrats of London are what Antichrist is also all about. As the Reverend Samuel Sherwood proclaimed, the horrible wild beast of Revelation 13 is applied to the Pope and his tyranny, and rightly, but it can't, he says, it can't be confined to so narrow a circle as Papal Rome. It is best applied to another persecuting power, the corrupt system of tyranny and oppression that has been fabricated and adopted by the ministry and parliament of Great Britain. Samuel West, another one of these great ministers, there are lots of these guys who find corruption and hierarchy, dependence on other people. Remember, to be corrupt is to be dependent on another person. The inability to make moral judgments, the inability to participate in politics, the inability to achieve oneself as a moral being. This is at once political and it's at once spiritual. Samuel West declared, "The description of every part of this beast," and we know the beast he has in mind, "will answer better as being understood of political rather than ecclesiastical tyrants. The political and the spiritual merge with one another. They are coterminous, and they are the great problem of the human condition." So what do we find with the Americans? Virtuous citizen is at the same time enlightened saint and a righteous congregant. Politics means salvation. The classical republic is in fact the godly company. That's what Christian fellowship is really all about. Progress is simply the unfolding of the apocalypse. We've seen how the one can dribble into the other. It's very easily done. We've seen this with the Enlightenment. Natural right, we hold these truths to be self-evident, is in fact the manifestation of the inner spirit. It is spiritual regeneration. The democratic era is in fact the millennium. The classical political theory in the classical world had talked about cycles of decline. When governments get overthrown, there is a king who becomes a tyrant. There are aristocrats who become oligarchs and so on. The cycle of decline is what we really talk about in that uniquely American piece of literature, a genre of literature, the Jeremiad. Civil despotism is the same thing as spiritual captivity. Classical corruption is the same thing as Christian sin. The ability to be spiritual, the ability to be moral, the ability to be political is one and the same thing. Corruption prevents you from being a moral person. It prevents you from exercising your morality. And isn't that really what original sin is all about? And thus, politics literally will liberate you. Natural rights are linked to spiritual regeneration. Christian faith, realized through civic action, is now made possible. There is the combination of the godly commonwealth, the Christian republic. This is America's experience. And American destiny, the Redeemer nation, how does this compare with these other countries that I've mentioned before? All of them, whether it's England or it's Spain, whether it's Scotland or it's Sweden, whether it's France or it's Italy, all of these countries are doing what? They are reinterpreting their past. The English past is interpreted as the story of English election. But the English past could be read in other ways. The Spanish past can be interpreted as how the Spaniards are the children of grace, the heirs of the Israelites. But we can read the Spanish past in another way. If we look to America from the very beginning, from 1630, if not 1607, and in fact you can do it for 1607 as well, for colonies that succeeded like Massachusetts, or for colonies that failed like Nova Scotia, it doesn't really matter. American destiny has always been eschatological. That's why they're so coterminous. That is why apocalyptic expectations are so saturated into the tissues of American political culture. America is different because the apocalypse is uniquely persuasive here, because it was founded with that expectation. It was maintained with that expectation. It was preached with that expectation. And frankly, my friends, it still is. These ideas cropped up elsewhere, but they became most persuasive in America because the whole history of America was the story of these expectations. You can't get away from it. 1630 to 1776. Freedom, justice, redemption. It was hard for Americans to imagine anything else. While that was not the case of the Swedes, it was not the case of the Germans, the Spaniards, or Englishmen. The apocalypse lay at the heart of the experience of America, and thus was so much a part of its tissue. Americans have a way of saying, it's awfully embarrassing, when I hear this in Europe, I tend to climb under the table and fake a French accent. All right, I don't know these people. We have no history. Of course Americans have history. Or rather, they have eschatology. It's not so much that America has a past that they can talk about in terms in which English people or French people will talk about it. Americans, of course, have history. All societies do. But what makes it so outstanding, American history is eschatology. And that doesn't sound like other history. Think of your dollar bill. Think of the backside where there's that pyramid, that eye, 1776 underneath. What is the slogan that you encounter there? Novus Ordo Seculorum. The new order of the ages. Now, the emblem is a Masonic one, but the slogan linked with it, and it's characteristically American to do this, the slogan talks about a reordering of time. Time assumes new meanings with the American Revolution and the Declaration of Independence. And for many people, it is hard to imagine how this can be anything other than the millennium. The American millennium is a two-part process. You may not have known this, but let me explain. Step one is Republican democracy, because Republican democracy makes spiritual freedom possible. Thus, the American millennium will have two dimensions. The spreading of Republican democracies throughout the world is the first step. But the second step is the spreading of the true faith. Spiritual tyranny had acquired its authority through political despotism. Overthrow that despotism. Set the people free. Create democratic republics, and Christianity will flourish. The destruction of tyranny will mean inherently the triumph of Christianity. The American clergy were awfully excited about this. John Mellon said in 1797, for example, "And may we not view it as at least probable that the expansion of the republican forms of government will accompany that spreading of the gospel in its power and purity, which the scripture prophecies represent as constituting the glory of the latter days?" The prophecies of Scripture talk about this latter-day glory, the millennium. And isn't that going to be made possible by the coming of democratic republics throughout the world? It seems, said David Austin in 1794, 3 years earlier, it seems no unnatural conclusion from ancient prophecy that in order to usher in the latter-day glory, two great revolutions are to take place, the first outward and political, the second inward and spiritual. The triumph of democracy would free mankind, both politically and spiritually, the Americans insisted. American self-assessment is sometimes rather generous, but it was also shared by a number of people in Europe at that time, and by some important people as well that I might point out to you. For example, Richard Price, the Englishman, one of the great spiritual leaders of England in the late 18th century, really did believe America was the harbinger of the millennium. And he was joined in this belief by no less than Joseph Priestley, the great British chemist, the co-discoverer of oxygen. Priestley said, next to the introduction of Christianity among mankind, the American Revolution may prove the most significant step in the progressive cause of human improvement. There's Christ and there's the USA. What more do you need? Okay? Priestley was endorsing democracy. There was a single force and will in the universe. It was God manifesting himself through man in the new American Republic. God's spirit within man became articulate in politics. Democracy was necessary for this reason. It would lead to a world, exactly as the Americans wanted and expected, of free democratic republics. The indwelling of the spirit was linked to the classical republic. And it's interesting. Let me make a quick aside. We've talked about various ways of imagining nature, linking with various ways of imagining religion, linking with various ways of imagining politics. It is not an accident that in the late 18th century, we don't have the mechanical, physical revolution of Newton, of Descartes, of Hobbes. It's in the late 18th century and the early 19th century that the chemical revolution occurs. And Priestley's an important part of it. Chemical bonding, a spiritualist, vitalist world, seemed to underwrite democracy in the world of Gerard Winstanley in the mid-17th century. And a kind of chemistry, a very sophisticated kind of chemistry, is linked with it now. It was no longer Winstanley's rather primitive, mystical world, but it was a chemical world of the inner spirit, of bonding and linkages. And these analogies were remarkably powerful for the Democrats, as indeed they had been historically for well over a century. Moreover, there's another dimension. Let me mention it just quickly. There's another dimension. With physics, you obviously have to have time, force operating through a space and through a distance. But it doesn't matter in physics whether you throw the ball through the window, and it goes over there, following Newton's formulae, or the ball comes, run the camera backwards. The ball comes through the window and I catch it. Same formula will describe it. Really doesn't matter. When we talk about chemistry, when we talk about thermodynamics, we don't end up in the same place. The first law of thermodynamics is you can't win. That is to say, you can't end up with more energy than you started with. The second one is you can't break even. You start over here, you end up over there, and that's not the same thing. There's a much deeper sense of progression built into thermodynamics than there is in classical physics. And that's characteristic of an age that much, much more wants to see change through time. Change through time. And this kind of thinking, this obsession with chemistry, and this is now real chemistry, was shared by American revolutionaries as well. There is an American chemistry that's linked with the revolution, just as Joseph Priestley is linked with the revolution, or the would-be revolution, the failed revolution in England, and he's a supporter of the United States. In fact, he migrates to the United States and dies there in 1804. It's the same way with Lavoisier and Sadi Carnot, Le Jacques Carnot, his father, linked with the French Revolution. In America, Benjamin Rush would work with chemistry and biology and would see this as integral to the revolution. Okay? Philosophical radicals, scientific radicals, political radicals, and spiritual radicals. But there weren't always people who said the republic and democracy meant God. There weren't always people who said America is the fulfillment of prophecy and thus of human destiny. There were people who admired America enormously, but didn't think God had much to do with the matter. Let me give you a couple of examples. Jeremy Bentham. Jeremy Bentham, a philosophical radical, as he would be called, the founder of philosophical utilitarianism, his associate James Mill, all of these people thought America was an enormously liberating event. They endorsed America, they endorsed the American Revolution with great enthusiasm, but they rejected both natural law and any spirituality that might be associated with it. There are no natural rights. There are no values planted out in nature. There is no programmatic somehow working itself out that God has planted in man and in nature. No, there's nothing of the sort. Why do we decide what we want? Why do we decide what's right, what's wrong? Why do we decide justice and injustice? It's very simple, says Jeremy Bentham. What is right is what feels good. If it feels good to you, you will think it is right. If it feels painful to you, you will think it is wrong. Out of that comes cause and effect. Out of that comes justice. Out of that comes morality. Any effort to get away from them will in fact be misleading. There is no programmatic. There is no apocalyptic. There is no God. What we do, we have to have democracy. What we do to get democracy is simply this. I cannot tell you what feels good to you. If I do that, says Bentham, I have declared war on you. To find out what feels good to you, to find out the goods or goods that you think are appropriate, there's only one thing I can do, and that's to ask you. And that's what voting's all about. That's what classical economics is all about. I've got to ask. We've got to take a poll. That's why we have democracy. We don't have democracy because it's the fulfillment of some sacred thing. We don't have democracy because there are values planted in nature. We have democracy because human beings decide what their needs are, and each individual alone can make that decision. Anything else is tyranny. Anything else subverts what people are. And thus, as we had Condorcet and Diderot on the one hand, taking the apocalypse, dropping it out of the equation, and ending up in, from civil religion, if you will, to no religion, we find something very comparable in the British Isles, amongst, again, great admirers of the Americans. But that's not the sort of thing that the Americans wanted to think about, at least many of them. And then the Americans got an enormous shot in the arm. If they expected democratic republics to expand throughout the world, this large but rather smallly populated country, a thinly populated country of only a few million, could hardly take on the world. But then in 1789, the biggest and most powerful country in the world declared for democracy, declared for civil liberty, declared for the rights of man and citizen. The French overthrew the monarchy. The French overthrew the hierarchy. And they didn't just do that. The French, not the Republic, mind you, the constitutional monarchy did what with the church? It nationalized it. It created a civil church. All priests suddenly became civil servants. They became citizens. The French did what Henry VIII had done in the 1530s. That's quite literally what happens. Priests are now civil servants for the state. They are citizens like you and me. They respond to no one. It is perhaps not surprising, and it certainly wasn't surprising to the Americans to hear that the Pope had condemned the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen. That didn't seem to square with his idea of the papacy at all. It seemed like, at least for a moment, that what Americans had hoped for was at last going to be realized. What Americans sought would now see fruition. Or would it? It seemed as though there was a lot of social radicalism over there in France. When you introduce democracy in the French context, in a feudal context, some people are going to lose a lot of property. When you introduce democracy, you're now talking about property shifts and radical changes, radical class tensions. about which Americans weren't then comfortable and have never been comfortable ever since. And then there was something else that troubled Americans as they looked over at the French Revolution. It didn't seem like the revolution was really leading to Christianity. Maximilien Robespierre turned out not to be a Congregationalist. He wasn't even an Episcopalian. In fact, to be fair, he did believe in civil religion. To be fair to Robespierre, he denounced, this is his word, that monster atheism. But his world was not the world of the Judeo-Christian apocalypse. It was far more the world of Thomas Jefferson. It was the world of the supreme being, that universal God that was not particular to the Jews or the Christians or the Muslims, that universal God, that impersonal God that spoke every bit as cogently to the Chinese for the very simple reason he didn't speak very much at all. In fact, he started the world and then went on. There was something clearly peculiar about France. Maybe France, the great proclamation of reason which we'd all been in favor of, maybe that was not going to work out. Maybe that was not going to lead to Christianity. Maybe democracy and religion didn't coterminate as Americans so instinctively had thought. And then there was Napoleon, another authoritarian figure, and he was a real problem. Timothy Dwight made the point in 1801, that infamous production entitled The Age of Reason. Where did it come from? Well, frankly, it came from France, and France no longer looks like the answer anymore. Liberty for infidels is not what we as Americans want. It's not the liberty of New England. This is a different kind of liberty. This is not the American expectation. And once again, this would happen again and again in American foreign policy. Somehow Christian society, American society, did not emerge from the French Revolution. And then, good heavens, something even worse happened. There was an election in 1800. And do you know who won that election? It was Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson was not a Christian. He was a deist, as you will remember. He is the first, the last, and the way things are going in the United States, surely the only non-Christian American president who will ever be elected. And this precipitates. If France was a problem, Thomas Jefferson was a heartache. Thomas Jefferson in the White House is an infidel. There's the cartoons of Jefferson pulling down the government with Satan helping him do it. Tom's pulling Tom for this purpose is Satan. New England begins to flirt with notions of counter-revolution as a result. Maybe the old regime is attractive after all. Hierarchy, discipline, order, parental authority, family values. That's what we need. And that's what they're saying in the early 19th century. I mean this quite literally. There's talk of secession right up to 1815. And there is something else. With somehow the failure of religious politics, the failure of Christian politics, we have in the early 19th century the Second Great Awakening, a new spiritual revival, a new let's get together and find God, let's have some conversions, brothers and sisters. This would not be like the first one. This would not have Jonathan Edwards' interest in the cutting edge of science and in the cutting edge of political philosophy. It wouldn't be Newton and Locke that informed this one. This would be popular, this would be democratic, but this would also be anti-intellectual. It has been described by historians as religion's revenge on politics. The Second Great Awakening. The Second Great Awakening was anti-clerical, all right. Implicit in this is that sectarian groups can find themselves, and that is democratic, and it really does deepen the democratic character of American society. It is one of the roots to Jacksonian democracy. There's no doubt about it. Religion is self-created. It's a free market for clergymen, even though they weren't keen on free markets generally. Those who can sell the product are those who people will follow. We have these great camp meetings. We have, truly, hallelujah, brother and sister. It is a populist impulse. It is anti-government. It is anti-authority generally. And it is characteristic of American life ever since. There's a great fragmentation of faith and authority. it leads to a kind of democratization. I think it really does democratize the real tissues of American society. It sets up tension between learning and feeling. It sets up tension between those guys at Harvard who think they've got the answer, who think they understand the millennium. But no, brothers and sisters, the millennium is out here in Western New York. The Second Great Awakening would change the face of American politics and American religion.